tonight on Arena. Sebastian Foulkes on his new novel, The Seventh Son, and Paddy Keelty and Shauna Kerslake in the new Northern Irish film, Ballywalter. +51 551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The author of Birdsong, Charlotte Grey, and the James Bond novel Devil May Care, as well as Jeeves and the Wedding Bell, Sebastian Foulkes, is as close to a Renaissance man as English fiction comes. His latest novel, The Seventh Son, marks his first foray into speculative fiction. It explores the past and a potential future with the human race of the human race via a childless English couple and a surrogacy. A tale that unfolds between 2030 and 2056 and fundamentally for me asks the question, is Homo sapiens just as wonderful a species as Homo sapiens likes to think it is? Delighted to have Sebastian Foulkes join us now. Was that one of the fundamental questions that was in your mind, Sebastian?
I think you've summed it up perfectly, Sean. I can't think why I bothered to write the book, really. just to flesh that question out a bit and make it more dramatic for the reader. But yes, that's what I'm asking, yes.
Yeah, and we might get to what kind of question or what kind of answers you come up with as we chat through the book. It starts with a surrogacy in the future. I mean, as I said in the introduction, you've written spy novels, you've written historical novels, or certainly novels that had a large amount of historical detail within them. And we've had the Jeeves and Wooster novel. What prompted you to look to the future, which isn't always a nice place to look, or it isn't? It's sometimes a very frightening place to look.
I didn't really start by saying I'm going to set something in the future. I started by wanting to write about Homo sapiens, us humans, why we are so odd, why we're so wonderful, so brilliant, so clever, so creative, but also so flawed and so violent, and why we are prone to delusions in old age and often at a younger age as well. And I wanted to look at how it might be if the Homo sapiens genes were diluted in some way. And I don't want to give away too much about how this happens. And I talked to a few people about the possibilities scientifically of whether this could take place. And they said, yes, it could. It could happen now. The science is there. The labs are there. The techniques are there. But they said it would be even more possible if you start a few years into the future. So I thought, well, I like nice round numbers, so I'll start in 2030. And the world I depict in 2030 is identical, really, to the one we live in today.
Yeah.
But as you say, it goes on till the main character, Seth, who is the young man who is the result of this IVF experiment or sleight of hand or interference, whatever you want to call it, until he's 25. And so by the time we reach 2055, 56, I think I felt obliged to record some difference in the way the world is and the way people get around and go about their business. But it's I had a lot of fun with that. And it isn't really a book. It's not a sci-fi book. It's not really a book about, I'm not solemnly predicting this is how the future will look, people. I'm solemnly asking exactly the question you touched on to begin with. Who are we and why are we like this?
One of the things that I loved in the debate that you have in the telling of the story is that, and again, we don't need to get into the whys and wherefores because it's just too complicating for the listener and also spoils the read. What we get essentially is a little mix of Neanderthal man in with Homo sapiens. Now, we all, of course, I'm including myself in this presumption, we all thought that Neanderthal man was rather a dim individual with very little to offer us wise old Homo sapiens. Did you find out different?
Yes, well, I did. I discovered in about 2012 that I was quite a considerably Neanderthal myself. So naturally, that improved my opinion of them no end. I had thought I was entirely rather dreary, Southern English, bit of Irish, a bit of, you know, German, and that's about it, really. But to find that I had 3.5% of a different species altogether, that sort of set me thinking quite a lot. And I've read a lot about Neanderthals, and I've spoken to people who know as much as can be discovered about them. After all, this is a people who went extinct 40,000 years ago. So, you know, you're working on very, very slim pickings, little bits of bone here and there. And you can see from various, well, essentially just from skeletons, that they had probably had the ability to speak. And you can see from the brain size, which is bigger than Homo sapiens, that they, you know, brain size doesn't tell you everything, does it? But it's an indication that they were reasonably intelligent. We believe they buried their dead. We believe they had some forms of ritual. And they were also a very hardy people. They lived for roughly, we think, 300,000 years, which is three times as long as sapiens has managed yet. And the other thing, of course, is that, you know, you and I, I'm assuming that you too have some Neanderthal DNA. When our Homo sapiens ancestors met some of these people, they must have been at least reasonably friendly, or, you know, sympathique, as the French would say, you know, enough to mate with anyway. So, yes, I suppose the idea that these were just sort of grunting, you know, monsters is not borne out by the facts at all.
Yeah, I'm sure I have my own fair share of Neanderthal man in there. I won't go into speculating what particular parts of me that is. However, one thing I did wonder, the interest in this for you as a writer, Neanderthal man and language. Was there anything there?
Nobody knows. And the thing is that we think they certainly had the capacity for language, because they had, you know, the voice box, the larynx, the lungs, and, you know, the things that you need physically, physiologically for it. It's possible that they had a different sort of language, that it was more, didn't have such a wide vocabulary, but nobody really knows. But, you know, when anyone is trying to define what makes human beings, by which we mean modern human beings, you, me, and everyone listening to this program, people say, oh, well, it may be to do with culture, it may be to do with cookery, it may be to do with husbandry, farming, use of tools, blah, blah, blah. But every single thing you can try to make us seem unique, it turns out that we're not unique, actually. We're just better at it than most people. You know, chimpanzees use tools, but they, you know, they haven't yet built a mobile phone or Sydney Opera House. And, you know, all sorts of creatures have ways of making decisions and operating in what we would think as distinctively human terms. So, you know, the confusing and interesting thing about Neanderthals is to imagine just how close they were to us, but how the differences might be not... the differences wouldn't necessarily be that they were less developed. The differences might be that they were more developed in some respects. And this is suggested in the book, that they have a rather more complex way of sensing the world. So we are limited to our five senses, and they may have had sort of other senses as well, or at least blends of our own.
I guess in some ways it's that kind of the arrogance of Homo sapiens to presume that all evolutionary developments are better than what went previous. They may just be different.
It's absolutely right. I mean, historically, humans have we looked at the apes in the sort of Middle Ages, and, you know, even after the Enlightenment, we looked at gorillas and orangutans as sort of fallen versions of the human. It wasn't until Darwin actually turned that on its head, and he said, actually, the humans are evolved versions of the apes. It's not going upwards. We're not better than. It's a sort of flat plane, if you like, and there are just different ways of being conscious. There are different ways of living. And, you know, once you discover that the Neanderthals buried their dead, you're saying that therefore they made a distinction between dying and living, and burial itself suggests a kind of reverence for life. And if you have a reverence for life, you pretty much got a sense of morality. And so, of course, all this is incredibly speculative, because nobody knows. But in a way, that's a bit of a gift for a fiction writer. It's harder work for a scientist, I must say.
However, you know, as you say, I don't want to get stuck into the plot and give too many things away. There is a surrogacy story within the telling of the novel. And part of that is Lucas Parn, the backer behind a place called the Parn Institute.
Yes.
Classic tech bro, I think is how we might describe him. Makes his billions through internet startups and that type of business. Anybody particular in mind when you were writing this character?
I had in mind, for a start, I wouldn't say he's a sort of classic. I tried not to make him a stereotype. I tried to get him away from that. So he doesn't talk like a sort of tech bro. I mean, in fact, he's Australian. He talks a bit like an outback farmer, as is remarked by somebody. But, of course, you know, there are references there to any sorts of rather megalomaniac billionaires you can think of. But I think what interested me about him and about them is a certain arrogance in which you think it shows itself in little ways. When you go to a restaurant, you don't order from the menu. You just tell the waiter what you want. And he says it's not on the menu. You say, well, go and get it. And you give him, you know, a £300 tip or €350 if you're in Ireland, and off he goes. But it also extends to a lot of people thinking they don't have to die. They can live forever. You know, people working hard on this now. And they think money can buy them everlasting life. But also they don't believe that they need to pay tax, really. Taxes are for the little people. And they don't believe that the normal rules of life, morality and ethics, really apply to them. They think they're above it. So when there's an air traffic control strike, you know, for instance, doesn't bother them. They've got to take another plane. They've got their own plane. And so I was interested to see how this being above it all attitude, which is very common in very wealthy people, in bankers and hedge funders and people, how that might apply to a seriously ethical issue about human life.
And I guess, too, I wonder to what extent, if I'm not drawing the analogy too far, are you looking at capitalism, I suppose, as the ultimate, you know, the highly evolved man, the highly successful man or woman? Capitalism is going to be part of that. That is part of our evolution and perhaps a deeply problematic part.
I think it is. I think I talked to a very interesting woman called Rebecca Ragg Sykes, who wrote a book about Neanderthals. And she, being a scientist, is super cautious and everything has to be fact-based. But I said, you know, okay, here are these two species who bred with each other, got on fine together. What do you think was the essential difference between them? And her guess, and she'll forgive me if I'm paraphrasing her wrong, was essentially Homo sapiens just had this unbelievable drive. So in this book, when I imagine a fateful meeting between a small group of Neanderthals and a small group of sapiens, and one of the reasons that the female Neanderthal wants to mate with the male sapiens is the feeling that it's actually pointless to resist, because these people will never not take what they want. And that is one of the defining attributes, I think, of our funny old species. And I don't want to come up overall misanthropic. I have some of my best friends are human beings after all. But we are very flawed and very odd and very worth looking at, I think.
And I guess that's part of the interest for a novelist is, you know, you are ultimately asking that question, what it means to be human. Has your view of that changed in any way from the writing of this book?
I know an awful lot more about genes than I did when I started, how they work, and I know a lot more about evolution. And I think, in a sense, I have become even more sort of modest, if it's not a boast to call oneself modest, a bit of a paradox there, about our place in the world. And we are, it could so easily have been otherwise. We don't really know what caused extinctions many years ago, probably massive changes of climate and a failure to adapt. But we could easily be living in a world in which there were three or four human species walking around together, as at one point there were. And on the other hand, if it was written in the stars or written in the climate that there was only to be one, it needn't have been us. It might have been one of the other ones, and it might have been one that was rather better adjusted to the rest of the world and better able to live with the rest of the world and with the other creatures on it.
Which begs the question from me about the several Sebastian folks that walk around together, the Sebastian folks that can write the James Bond novels, the Sebastian folks that can write the Jeeves and Wooster novels, and the Sebastian folks that writes The Seventh Son. Are they very different species of Sebastian folks all gathered in one, or does one of them rise to the fore? Has one of them evolved further?
Oh, but of course, I also write books under the name of Sebastian Barry, you see. I met Sebastian Barry in London once. He was a most delightful man, as well as being a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
He told me that, I'm sure you've interviewed him many times, he told me he had his son as a screensaver of me, just to annoy his father.
There you go. But talk to me a little bit about those three. I mean, there's more than three aspects of you, obviously, Sebastian, there are a lot more. But is it a very different act writing in your own voice in The Seventh Son than it is maybe writing in the voice of Ian Fleming, or P.G. Wodehouse in the other two cases?
Yes, I mean, those two, they're a kind of exercise. And it's a bit as if you're a saxophonist and, you know, your basic style is to play like John Coltrane. But if somebody said to him, now give us a solo that sounds like Lester Young or Ben Webster, he could do that. And it would be a slight parody, perhaps a bit naughty, but you can do that. It's a question of having an ear, really, for other people. And Ian Fleming wasn't very difficult to imitate because Fleming's style is actually very straightforward. He writes like a newspaper man, which indeed he was, where he worked for Reuters. P.G. Wodehouse was much more difficult to imitate because although his books are comic and, faintly ridiculous in many ways, they are beautifully written and his prose is like sort of sponge sugar. So that was much, much harder to catch. It's like being able to imitate people's voices, really. Mm. Some people have got a knack for it and some people can't do it to save their lives. But as for my own books, it doesn't really seem to me to matter. I mean, The Seventh Son is set in the 40s and Charlotte Gray is set in the 40s. One's in the 1940s and one's in the 2040s. I don't really see any distinction. Of course, the future is a hell of a lot easier to research because there isn't any research.
Yeah, you can make it up much easier. I was tickled when I read, I can't remember who it was specifically said it, but I am using somebody else's phrase here, I have to be honest, when they say, people think of you often as the State of the Nation, the writer of the State of the Nation book, but that this, The Seventh Son, was a State of the Species book, which I thoroughly agreed with. How bad or how good a state is the species in?
Nobody can answer that question. But we will continue to change and to evolve. And some of the things that is possible, I think, that over some hundreds of thousands of years, if we haven't all died out by then, if we haven't burned ourselves to death, that some of the difficulties we have, and indeed some of the gifts we have, may not stay with us. I mean, we don't need to all this sort of super science and our mental abilities. They didn't come about through the normal processes of natural selection, and they may be just in our genome because they're being constantly selected because they're sitting next to something which really is vital, like disease resistance or so on. And it may be that in 100,000 years' time, our deep descendants will be rather more simple creatures and perhaps rather more peaceful. Who knows? Let's hope.
Sebastian, lovely to have spoken with you.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's Sebastian Folkes speaking to us about his latest novel, The Seventh Son, which is published by Penguin. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Singer-songwriter David Keenan hails from Dundalk. Still in his 20s, he has released three albums while touring consistently since 2017. Having reunited with Gavin Glass, who produced the 2020 debut A Beginner's Guide to Bravery, David is now working on a new studio album ahead of a headline gig at the National Concert Hall tomorrow evening. Delighted that David is with me in studio now. We're going to start with your latest single, which will be off the new album when you get that far down that track, David. This is a song called An Irish Song.
Don't let your past get in your way. Wish your mother a happy Valentine's Day. She said your sister had a minor crash.
David Keenan there with his new single, An Irish Song. David with me in studio tonight ahead of his performance in the National Concert Hall tomorrow evening. When you call a song an Irish song like that, David, I'm guessing you're speaking to the nation in some way, or there's something about the nation that's getting at you.
Yeah, I think that song's coming from a place, obviously, a personal place of being blinded to my own goodness and my own worth and self-deprecation and having the head down and trauma, basically. But I think it's universal, given what we've come through over the last few years. And I think I'm trying to remind myself not to suffer from the amnesia that we've suffered from in the past and that I can suffer from. You forget pain very easily and then it comes up again and again. It's just about empowerment. You know, you're always good enough. You're always worth it. Mm. But if your eyes are covered in whatever you're going through, you can't see it.
And was there something, you know, there's a couple of lines in that song that really jump out and you don't let your past get in your way. So was there something from your past? Was there something there that was stopping you, that was bothering you?
Well, I mean, I could think of a few things, but even just living in the past in your head and you're not being present. And there's things that I didn't work through that came up. You can only push things down for so long and they eventually come up to the surface, you know, and then you work through them and you get through the pain and there's healing occurs and it's growth then, you know. But I think in terms of Ireland and Irishness, just our history and how that manifests, you know, in alcoholism and addiction, and that's just, it's trauma that hasn't been dealt with. It's just hit the escape button, hit the eject button, you know. And this is my way of dealing with that, these songs.
So the singing of it is part of that, dealing with it.
Part of the venting, yeah.
And again, the other line that jumped out at me was, who's to know if you're not okay? It's okay to say things aren't great. It's all right to say that.
Yeah, but who's to know if you're not looking? Mm. You know, so if you're not looking at, if you're not going there, if you don't go there, you'll never maybe get through to the other side of that pain, and it changes everything. When your perspective changes, everything changes, you know.
And you're speaking in very personal terms there, but I think you're speaking in societal terms as well, because you were part of the big musicians' protest recently in and around the housing crisis, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it was that big. I mean, it was my birthday, and I saw statistics online being shared, and I just thought, I can just reshare this, and I'll forget about it in an hour that I feel.
And these were statistics about homelessness and housing problems.
Yeah, it was 68% of adults under 35 are living with their parents in this country. I just thought, if I can stew on this, or I can actually use maybe my birthday as an excuse just to put out the call. If anybody wants to come outside the door with me on that day, I'll have my guitar and my flask of tea. And I'm reminding myself that it's real life energy that we need, not just, obviously people couldn't make it for certain reasons, but sharing something online sometimes isn't enough. You know, we have a guitar, we have a voice, we don't need officialdom to tell us we can protest, it's in our constitutional right, you know, so that's the thinking behind it. And it was beautiful, it was really uplifting.
Yeah, I think there were a number of musicians then did join you and you all sang there on the day.
Yeah, my sisters were with me and well-wishers came along. People thought we were busking, we had to give the money back. But it was beautiful, just goodness, you know.
And had you a sense after that, some sense of achievement that you had said what you wanted to say, that you'd made your statement in, I suppose, outside the government buildings? Where else? Where? What better place to make a statement?
Yeah, I did. I slept easier that night because there's a kind of a inherent shame that comes. Well, I was feeling it anyway, of just, this is terrible, you know. Actually, the initial thing, I shared that statistic and I said, we need to take to the streets. Mm. And about a half an hour later, I had the idea. And I said to my grandfather, do you think this is a good idea? He said, go for it. Because he was in the unions, the shoe and boot industry in the 50s, you know. And it was just nourishment, you know, because I think there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear, and you're a musician. People are worried about their careers and they're worried about putting their toe, you know, in the wrong water, etc. I just thought, this is something I feel passionate about. I'm living with my grandfather at the moment. And if I wasn't living with him, I couldn't afford to make this new record, because there's no pension, there's no big savings. So it's directly affecting me. And I needed to just make some sort of a stand, you know.
And is that, are you living with him in Dundalk?
Yeah.
Because the new record, you're doing it on your own record label. So it's totally self-funded. There's no record company saying, here's a few bob to make some music.
Every ticket, every t t-shirt record that's bought at the gigs. It's helping. Everyone's coming to this gig tomorrow night in the National Concert Hall. And it's been the case really with that core audience for the last number of years. Just people, the support, the belief, you know.
And the National Concert Hall, I mean, that is quite a venue to be. And is it just you and your guitar? Will there be others with you?
It will be just me and my guitar in part, but it's going to be the band, full band. It's going to be people who I've sung with over the years. It just felt like in 2020 when everything happened, the first record was really, you know, like anesthetized, do you know what I mean?
And because I remember that. I think we spoke to you around that time and you were all excited about the new album. Here we go, here's my first album, and then bang, everything shut down. That must have been hugely frustrating. Is this the first time really that you'll get a chance to tour a record? Is the new album ready for that?
Yeah, it feels that way. I mean, the second record came out during the whole thing. Mm. The third record was really going independent and clearing the house out, really, of, you know, stripping everything back. And now this is the first record that I can really get a chance to tour and promote, and it's independent again. But these things happen. I think I'm a better songwriter person, because of the whole experience of just getting through the last few years and leaning into the music, leaning into the songs, you know.
And the song that you just sang for us, an Irish song, I mean, the other line that rang for me was the line about Russia invading Ukraine. So these are all, I'm guessing, pretty new songs that has to have been written in the last 18 months or so, given that the invasion was in, what, February of 2022. So are they all brand new songs?
Yeah, all of them, yeah.
How frightening is that? How good is that?
You know, I started working on this record in 2022, so I started working on it, and then when I heard the songs back, I kind of was shook because of what is explored. You talk about being personal. What's explored on the record and some of the musicality. There's a lot of soul, and I dropped the guitar. And I think I just needed a bit of time to process. This is where I'm going next. I did the whole Crude thing, which was the independent thing. And now I'm back with this record, and I've got new songs that I'm bringing into it and getting string arrangements in there, and it's just great. It's just great to be alive and to be able to do this. You know, it's great to be uninhibited. I just, God bless the music. You know?
Is this the first time playing the National Concert Hall, by the way? Is this your first time on that main stage with an audience there?
It is my own gig. I supported Richard Thompson there in 2018. But this will be my first headline gig there, yeah. It's iconic. I was in doing a bit of filming just to hear the voice coming back.
Yeah, I saw it's that online,
magic.
Yeah.
It's going to be magic. It's going to be magic.
Yes, so you. In fact, you did an Irish song, I think.
I did indeed.
You released it. There was a bit of it online just to see you up on that stage.
For sure, yeah.
The feeling when you were up there, because that's what you'll have tomorrow night. Except there'll be people in the house tomorrow night as well.
Just a real okay. You have to really step into this now. Do yourself justice. The last few months, I've been back in Dundalk. I've been doing a bit of boxing. I've been training. I have a nice bath in the garden. I've been in that. I was in it this morning. You know, I just think a couple of years have passed and you appreciate everything that bit more. And these are the kind of rooms I want to be playing. I feel like I'm part of inhibiting my growth in the past as well as everything that happened. But I feel like I've never really been able to show my potential. Yeah. And I feel like I'm leaning into that again. So,
and funny that you've mentioned your grandfather, you've mentioned Dundalk and boxing and all the rest of it. Dundalk is still very much at the heart of what you're doing as a musician, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's I lived with my grandfather when I was 18 before I left, and I'm back there over 10 years later. It's great to get that time with him, but when you reconnect with that part of your identity, and I can walk around, I can hear the accent turned up to 15. And I'm going to the local football games, and I'm, you know, it's a great town. It's a town of you know, great winners under harsh circumstances. And that kind of fire in the belly, it was the love-hate relationship growing up with Dundalk. But now it was the makings of me. That kind of, there was never any pats on the back. I had to earn everything, and great. And it gave me that edge, I suppose, you know.
As well as the new album, David, there's also Scannon, Chalk the News. Scannon coming up, a film coming up on TG Cahir, Cardatar, A Geshlan Shin. What are we getting?
Scannon, Sais Ach, Le Paddy Hayes, and Director Shin. Just Fui Masail.
So your life, but a little bit odd. What do you mean? How odd is it?
Well, just the way, I suppose, we're going to shape it more abstract. But yeah, back to Dundalk. Essentially, the journey of getting to a point in the music industry where I maybe had an opportunity to go one way and be mainstream, and I took the other path and did it my own way, and then the fallout of that, and then coming back around to, you know, the growth and getting to the concert hall, and just, I suppose, my grow and the link that the passion I have for music and art as this kind of transcendent thing. And people have sneered at that in the past, the way I speak about it, but I speak about that because of direct experience of what it's done to my life. It's changed my life, it's saved my life, it's inspired me from the circumstances that I came from to get to play the likes of the concert hall. And that's a real magical thing, so...
The second song you're going to perform to us speaks directly to Dundalk. For those who don't know, you might explain where or what the Friary is.
The Friary, yeah, well, it's a Dominican church. My grandfather used to tie his dog to it, but somewhere I used to meet a friend of mine, and I think the phrase is, when we were together, it was like pouring petrol on a fire. But I got a song out of it anyway.
The Friary, David Keenan.
Memories of Risler Green floating down your sofa seams. We're so happy, happy as Larry, flicking ash into a glass, a friend or foe from recent past. You ignite me, traffic lights invite me, floating down your street.
David Keenan with his song The Friary. David plays the National Concert Hall tomorrow evening, September the 13th. You can find out full details on nch.ie. The County Down village of Ballywalter gives its name to a new film starring Seán Carslake and Patrick Keelty. Yes, the same Patrick Keelty who will present his first late show this Friday evening. They play Shane and Eileen, two individuals at crisis points in their separate lives when their paths cross. She is driving a taxi, having returned to Belfast after a short-lived move to London. He's a new passenger, back living in Ballywalter. His marriage is in serious trouble and he's starting a course in stand-up comedy. Ballywalter is the debut feature film from director Prasanna Puanaraja, and I'm delighted that he is with me in studio this evening. I have to say, Prasanna, you cannot have known that Patrick Keelty would present his first late show the Friday before you guys would get your film into cinemas.
Actually, I've masterminded the whole thing. It's a web spun solely by me. No, we absolutely could not have known. We did not know, and it's brilliant for Patrick. It's an amazing moment for him, I think, and it's wonderful for the film as well because it's a small film, the kind of films that really do have to fight to be heard and discoverable, you know, in a very busy marketplace, film and TV. So, you know, it's a thrilling time for Patrick, and we're lucky to be kind of floating around it.
Yeah, and you know what? Putting the Late Late Show to one side, if this were just Patrick Keelty having starred in this film opposite Seán Carslake, people would be saying, I never knew he had that acting ability within him. I mean, obviously, the stand-up comedy was always there. We were aware of the presenting ability. But maybe if you talk a little bit about his character and the dynamic between his character and Seán Carslake's character, we'd get a sense of the kind of very delicate performance that are demanded from both of them.
Well, Seán plays Eileen, who is a woman in her late 20s, who's kind of crash landed back in Belfast, having sort of tried to make a bit of an escape to freedom, as she sees it, to London. And it's all kind of gone a bit wrong for her. She's on the skids a little bit, and she is driving a taxi. She's driving her ex-boyfriend's taxi, which she's borrowed to just try and earn a bit of cash. And she's back at home, but my mum and sister are sort of wondering when she's going to get out. You know, they've got a baby. Mm. Her sister's got a baby coming. And she starts taking a regular fare from this guy holed up in Ballywalter, who initially has quite a sort of, I guess, kind of a flat energy. And the film is about the kind of breaking down of that initial barrier and the growing sort of strange friendship between these two people, Eileen and Shane. And yeah, it's a sort of, it's a small film with kind of huge collisions, really. Yeah. And yeah, we were, when we were thinking about casting right at the start of the process, Patrick's name came up early on. It was actually a suggestion of Stacey Gregg, the writer, who was intrigued by Patrick's career trajectory and where he had been moving into kind of documentary making a few years ago.
Yeah, he made it specifically, there was a documentary about his father and around the Troubles. His father died during the Troubles, during the Troubles.
That's right. He made a film called, I think it's called My Father, The Peace Deal and Me. And it's a very beautiful film. And I watched that film and... you know, my family is Sri Lankan Tamil, and we have a similar, if very different, inherited trauma landscape in our communities as the Sri Lankan Tamil diaspora globally from our own civil conflict. And so there were aspects of it that I recognized. There were aspects of it that I found searching in a way that I think my own community has really struggled to achieve. And I found his, the change in him, or the seeing the real him, I guess. And I thought that he was at an interesting point in his life where, sort of in the middle of his life, trying to make sense of the first half to kind of get through the second half in some way. And that's very much where Shane is. And I've been an actor for 15, 20 years. I think actors come in all shapes and sizes and all provenances, all backgrounds. You know, there are people that have never been anywhere near a stage. There are people who've been to stage school since they were three. And Patrick's audition, he didn't do an audition for this. His audition was really those documentary films and seeing the real him and seeing someone who was prepared to look down the well.
Yeah, and as an actor, people might know you from season 5 of The Crown, Martin Bashir. You played that part in The Crown. You were also part of 10%, as Call My Agent was called in its English language version. Of course, as you well know, Prasanna, one of the problems with, in inverted commas, non-actors when they come to doing some acting is that they come in with, you know, at top speed, doing loads and loads of acting, and certainly on screen and even on stage, one could argue, you certainly don't want to see the acting. You don't want to see the wheels in motion. You want it to look like a person, not a character.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly the question when you're working with someone who, you know, you don't know as an actor, as a performer. And so we needed to do a lot of work, a lot of rehearsal, but not to kind of tell him how to act. It was more just about allowing him and Shauna both the confidence to work in a space that was unfamiliar to them. In Shauna's case, she's from Tala. You know, not East Belfast. And
it's very much a Belfast character.
It's very much a Belfast character. And those aren't accents that are kind of cheek by jowl. It's really quite a leap, like kind of literally where it lives in your head, you know. And so both of them were working in these quite like divergent spaces for them. And that was useful for both of them to know that the other had something they were just sort of like also worrying about, so that they weren't kind of feeling too much like they were in there on their own with a huge concern or fear or something, you know. You know, Patrick is a great listener. And Shauna was talking about this. We did a Q&A event in Belfast yesterday, actually, for the film. And she was very aware, real time in performance, of the quality of his listening. And so one of the things that we were working on was just the reality of the process of listening and responding. And in his case, I think he's sort of been doing that for 30 years, you know. So yeah, there's always a kind of set of skills that you can bring to bear as an actor that might not really be anything to do with acting. And Patrick was amazing at kind of digging into the toolbox and just working out what he could use, as was Shauna.
Well, I suppose acting is doing, not pretending, as loads of people seem to.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you don't want to see the pistons moving.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to a clip featuring Shauna Kerslake and Patrick Keelty And because she's a taxi driver and he's a passenger, lots of their scenes, in fact, are in the taxi, which is further, I suppose, compressing things down into a very intimate space. So there's going to be no shouting across the car at each other.
Definitely.
It's going to have to be very real. Here they are. He has been attending a comedy course. He wants to become a comedian, which is a lovely kind of double take if you think of his character. So the character wants to become a comedian, possibly should be thinking twice about that decision. And he's talking to Shauna Kerslake's character about the various comedians that he loves, etc. in this scene.
What are you watching?
This comedy stuff.
For your thing? So you want to be a comedian?
Not really. It's just like a wee course. You know, at the end, we all try out our material, a sort of wee gig thing.
Right. Took me. And what do you watch?
All different. Who do you like?
Comedians?
Aye.
I don't know. Who do you like?
I like a lot of the American comedy drama, you know. Saturday Night Live, great tradition, stand-up. Stuart Lee, Bill Hicks, Chris Rock, some of the old-school British classics, Morgan Wise, Monty Python.
He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy.
Patrick Keelty and Shauna Kerslake in a scene there from Ballywalter. And director of Ballywalter, Prasanna Puanaraja, is with me in studio this evening. You mentioned, Prasanna, about, you know, the Northern Irish aspect of it, and when you were talking about Patrick Keelty, the trauma of his childhood, what he witnessed in terms of the death of his father. Interestingly, Shauna Kerslake's character is dealing with the loss of a father. Now, we don't get a full outline of exactly what that loss was, but we are dealing with a Northern Ireland and a Belfast region in the film, which is post-conflict. How important is that aspect of the temporal setting of the piece, as opposed to the physical setting, which I'll talk about in a minute?
Well, it's both vital and central on the one hand, and also not really present in the way that, like any traumatic reality, is both things. There's a kind of quantum quality to it. It's in everything, but it's also not there, you know. There's a secrecy to it, but there's also a kind of frankness to it. So I just wanted to be completely honest with, I mean, I've been working in various ways in Belfast for the last 10 years, and I wanted to be honest about what you see there. If you drive a taxi, if you drive a car around, you know, what you see on the walls, what you don't see on the walls anymore. What happens when you meet extraordinary, interesting, fascinating people, and what they share and what they don't, and how they don't, usually through comedy, through a kind of an electric patter. And so I think, you know, together with Stacey and all of us, really, we wanted that reality around Belfast and the north of this island to be alive in the film, without wishing to or really needing to kind of cast a stark light on it.
Yeah, because there is this idea, I suppose, that, you know, each of the characters, particularly the Shane and the Eileen character of Patrick Keelty and Shauna Kerslake, both of them are dealing with traumas of some kind. And I wondered about this idea of, because they've been through a period of conflict, how they find themselves unable to deal with stuff because of all of that in their background. And this isn't spelt out in the in the film. That's one of the lovely things about it. It's kind of, it's hinted at without being, you're not beaten over the head with a mallet about it.
I mean, you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. I think it's about your ability to heal and what is in your personal journey, your personal history, but also your lineage, like what's in your bones that is able to heal.
And while all that delicacy and all that those debates and ideas around healing are present, there's also some great comedy in it, we should say. Not all of it from those who are training to be comics.
And, well, not for the right reasons.
You know, some of them, Yeah, some of them really should really rethink whether they should be in that course or not. And that in itself is funny, how bad they are as comics. But, you know, there is a lot of that kind of black Northern Irish humour that maybe people will be familiar with. Was that something that you have admired or wondered at in your time?
Definitely.
I actually more
than that, I just sort of recognised it. It's the absolute energy of my extended family, my Sri Lankan Tamil extended family. You know, the sort of raucous nature of an anecdote well told in a Sri Lankan sitting room in the 90s is plucked straight from, you know, that kind of energy of that you find in the film.
One final thing I would like to touch on, because the Ballywalter, I mean, most people won't even know the village. It is a real village, I think, isn't it? It is a real village. And are we up at that part of the Ards Peninsula? It's a very specific kind of shoreline, which makes the driving, the taxi parts of the movie, it makes it quite interesting, because you're constantly along the seafront, and I'm sure somebody can psychoanalyze what that does to us when we're watching a film. But it's a very interesting landscape to drive through and to film through.
Very, yeah. I mean, it is absolutely a real village on the coast there, on the Ards Peninsula. It's about halfway down the peninsula, about a third of the way down. And there's a sort of string of them all the way down. There's Donaghadee, Mill Isle, Ballywalter. And then you have, I think, Port of Ogie and Ballyhalbert.
You spent a lot of time up there.
I spent a lot of time up there. I drove the peninsula, every single road on that peninsula, so many times. There's a really particularly beautiful part where it gets quite rocky and you can see the road snaking round. And there's an enormous piece of granite that has somehow found its way there. And on the road into Belfast, it says something like Eternity Where? Eternity where?
As question mark. Yeah.
And on the other side, it says, prepare to meet thy God. And it's been daubed on in white emulsion by someone. And it's sat sort of in the water by this road in the lock. And so it's absolutely, I mean, it's from Shane's point of view, it's completely where you go to hide. Yeah. No one would ever find you out there. Yeah. But it's also where you might go to try and take the first step if you needed a bit of space.
Yeah.
You do have these two parallel bodies of water that probably do reflect a couple of different mindsets.
Absolutely. And as they say, somebody else can psychoanalyze that. You mentioned Shane there. For people are wondering, who's Shane? He's the kind of name of the Patrick Keighley character. Prasanna, wonderful to speak with you, and congratulations on the movie.
Well, thanks for watching it. Thanks very much for having me.
That's Prasanna Puanaraja, and Ballywalter is the title of the film. It's in selected cinemas from September 22nd. And just to let you know, there will be a special preview screening of Ballywalter at the Irish Film Institute at 6:30, 6:30 on Wednesday, the 20th of September. And there will be a live Q&A with Patrick Keighley after that screening as well. I wonder, will they ask him any questions about the Late Late? I guess they might ask one or two. That is our lot for this edition of Arena. What day is it? It is Tuesday's Arena. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Pat Carney was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. And Fake No Brain On will be with you after the news.